Ham and chorizo, bacon and spare ribs, prosciutto and tenderloin. Chances are the mention of these pork products has you either thinking about dinner tonight or groaning in disgust. For the long and complicated relationship between man and pig, such polarizing reactions have been common for centuries. From ancient kosher laws to modern bacon festivals, the pig has been called the most loved and loathed domesticated animal. In this hour of midday, we hear why these highly intelligent creatures have been written off as lazy, filthy gluttons to some and favored as dinner to others. Historian Mark Essig and the snout-to-tail history of the lesser beasts. The whole hog coming up after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here for the second hour of today's show. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm going to take a dive into some unusual history this hour, and look at the long and complicated relationship between man and pig. For centuries, pork has been off limits in the diets of many for religious reasons. The animal was and is considered impure by about a quarter of the world's population. Even as the religious stigma has cooled off a bit over the centuries, pork lagged behind beef and came to be seen as the meat of the poor. Mark Essig, our guest this hour, says that the 10,000-year history of the domestic pig is a tale of both love and loathing. The problem of the pig seems especially relevant today, he writes in his new book, at a time when choosing food is more complicated than ever, when buying a pork chop raises thorny questions about the environment, public workers' rights, and animal welfare, it makes sense to take a look back at what has been, for several thousand years, the most controversial of foods. What might come as a surprise to many is that man and pig share many similar qualities, including our sensitivity, our independence, and our omnivorous diet. And pigs have the capacity to be quite ornery. Mark Essig has said, compared to cows and sheep, pigs are arrogant. Of all the animals commonly eaten by humans, the pig is the only one that will return the favor. Mark Essig is a historian. He resides in Asheville, North Carolina, where he was teaching journalism at Warren Wilson College there when he came up with this idea for this book, Lesser Beasts, it's called, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig, published by Basic Books. Mark Essig, thank you for joining us here on the Midday Show on WYPR.
Thanks, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you get to this subject? What were you thinking about, Mark?
Well, when I moved to Asheville, North Carolina, about 8 years ago, we're in the mountains, and right in the center of town, there are statues of pigs. So being a historian, I started to look into this, and I read some local history that explained that back before the Civil War and for a couple decades after, tens of thousands of pigs, as many as 150,000 pigs a year, used to be driven through town on the hoof every winter. You know, everybody's heard about cattle drives, but nobody's heard about hog drives on this vast scale. My first reaction was just sheer delight. Like, who knew that a pig could walk that far or that they would travel in the direction you wanted them to go? But then when I dug into it deeper, it got more complicated because these pigs started out in an area of eastern Tennessee where there was a little mini corn belt where they grew a lot of corn, used it to fatten a lot of hogs, but didn't have a place to sell it. But then down in South Carolina, in Georgia, they grew a lot of cotton. They owned a lot of slaves, but they didn't raise food. So you had the demand in Tennessee. I mean, you had the demand in South Carolina and Georgia. You had the supply in Tennessee. In between lay the Blue Ridge Mountains, and the only way to get from here to there was to drive them. So thousands of hogs on the hoof over the mountains every winter. I was just so delighted by the idea that I started to dig into it and follow those pigs down the drover's roads.
Wow. You know, in Baltimore, we have a pig town. It's called that because for years, pigs were driven through the streets of Washington Boulevard, and even some of the side streets through Pigtown on the way to the slaughterhouse. It's still called that. Some people want to call that neighborhood something else now, but Pigtown remains. But so a drive of pigs, but not quite of the dimension that you're talking about there.
Well, you know, they could have been. And incidentally, I will vote in favor of keeping the Pigtown name forever and ever. Yeah. But Baltimore was actually the destination of some of the earliest and biggest pig drives. The Corn Belt got its start in Ohio right after, say, about 1810, 1820. And similarly, there was no market for the hogs there. And a lot of them were driven over the old National Road all the way to Baltimore. So it was a similar phenomenon, although there, that route tended to be replaced by first water transportation down the Ohio River and later rail transportation. So it's part of the same history.
So you wondered about how did the pig come to be a domesticated animal? How did it come into contact with humans? And why this love-loathing thing that's gone on for centuries, why it's considered impure, filthy animal by some, and others it's considered lunch. You know, those are the two things I think you wondered about.
Yeah, and to get to the root of that complicated question, you really have to start at the beginning. The pig is descended from the Eurasian wild boar. This is a wild pig, a wild creature that lives all over Eurasia from Southeast Asia all the way to England. And it's thought that this creature became the domestic pig on a number of occasions independently. But there's one instance that we know the most about, and that happened in what's now Turkey about 10,000 years ago. And what archaeologists think happened is that this is back when agriculture was first getting started, when people, for the very first time, stopped being hunter-gatherers and settled down into permanent villages. And when people get together in large groups, one of the things they're best at is producing garbage. So these people living in villages, they had butchery scraps from animals they hunted, they had burnt food from their dinner, they had spoiled food reserves. And so what they think happened was that the very first as soon as these villages were founded, wild boars started lurking into town to gobble up this garbage, these food scraps on the streets. Some of these individuals were better than others. Like, essentially, what had been created in these villages was a new ecological niche, and the wild Eurasian boars wandered into town to fill that niche. Over hundreds and thousands of years, gradually, the ones who were best at this separated themselves out into their own species. So you could really say that whereas most other animals like goats and cows were domesticated by people, pigs essentially domesticated themselves in order to exploit this new resource.
I can see it. It's a beautiful description of it. They learned to live with humans, as you say, in order to exploit a new resource of food.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can compare that, for instance, with goats. They've dug up these piles of goat bones dating back 40,000 years in these caves in mountains in what's now Iran. And they think it was a very different process there, because what they can tell from these bones is that in the earliest heaps, they seem to have been killing goats almost indiscriminately, any age, any sex. But then by about 10,000, 8,000 years ago, they seemed to be selectively culling out the young males. So they were doing what we would call a sustainable harvest. You kill the males, which you don't need for breeding, you preserve the females. And gradually, by following these goats over the open territory, the process of hunting them gradually turned into herding them and finally domestication. So that was a process in which the humans were the most active in controlling it. With pigs, it was just the opposite. The pigs really, you could almost say, they volunteered for a life of domestication. And I would imagine that they came to regret it at some point.
Pigs are omnivores. They'll eat almost anything: meat, roots, grain, grass, seeds. I mean, they'll eat what we eat, right? And do scientists believe that was always the case, or something that evolved over time?
Well, pigs are often described as being one of the more primitive of mammals. Hmm. And I think that's actually true. When you think about some of the more dramatic animals that are wandering across the savanna in Africa, giraffes, antelope, they have all evolved very specialized skills in order to eat different grasses, different leaves, different plants. They're very specific to a certain niche where they are. What happened with pigs essentially is when pigs first evolved, much of the earth would have been wooded, and a pig was more of a generalist. It could eat just about anything, and living in the forest, anything that was available to them. These other animals grew specialized, but the pig sort of got left behind at school. But being a generalist has its advantages, as people would learn. Whereas if, say, a koala loses its one source of food, which is the eucalyptus leaf, it's pretty much out of luck. But if the pig loses one source of food, it can just turn to another one. And I think that's really why you can understand the success of the pig. It's a generalist, meaning that it can adapt itself to nearly any situation. And you could say the same thing about people, and that's really why we've gotten along so well for so long.
So going back some 10,000 years to the time of the hunter-gatherers and then coming forward through all those centuries, something happened there. So somewhere along the line, this partnership between pig and man, at least for some part of the male, the human population, became poisoned. A prejudice developed against the pig.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that you can really trace it back to the origins of the pig itself. What did they evolve to do? They evolved to eat garbage. And to us and to people long ago, that there was a problem there. The most famous instance of the pork prohibition is set down in Jewish scripture in the book of Leviticus, which may have been set down about 700, 800 BC or so. But I was surprised to learn that when that prohibition was codified, that actually would not have surprised most of the neighbors of the Jews, because people in Mesopotamia, people in Egypt, none of them, at least the priestly classes, the bureaucrats, none of them were eating pork, and they certainly never sacrificed pork to the gods. All of these people considered pigs to be unclean, and you see a lot of references in the literature to the eating habits of pigs. They would eat dead animals in the streets. There were recordings that they would eat the feces of humans and other animals. And what you see expressed in these texts is sort of a visceral sense of disgust. So when the Jews got around to banning pork, this was really an expression of a rather widespread cultural belief in the Near East that these things were unfit to eat. It doesn't mean that pigs entirely disappeared from the region, but what you do find where you dig up pig bones, it tended to be from the areas where the common people were living. If you had access to other sources of food, you didn't eat pork. If you were hungry, you kept pigs because they were so extraordinarily useful. You didn't need land. You didn't need pasture. You could keep them around the house. You could let them scavenge on the streets, and then they could provide a source of meat. You know, most people throughout history have not had the luxury of being able to turn up their noses at any available food. Mm-hmm. It was only the people who could afford to who did so.
Do you mind if we go over Leviticus, specifically what it says to the Israelites, that they could eat any beast that parteth the hoof and is cloven-footed and cheweth the cud? Now, that means cows, sheep, and goats are okay, but pigs aren't, because even though he divide the hoof, excuse me, Mark, and be cloven-footed, yet he cheweth not the cud. So the cud, C-U-D, is what separates them.
Yeah, and that goes back to the fact of pigs being omnivores. They don't chew the cuds because they don't eat grass and leaves. They have a simple stomach, much like humans, which means they can digest anything. These other creatures, they eat only plants. Therefore, they remain pure, and one sign of that purity is their cud chewing, because that's the process needed to digest grass and leaves.
And that gets us to this conversation. John Travolta, and Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction sitting down to breakfast. And here, I think this brief scene from that movie encapsulates this great divide.
What's the bacon?
No, man, I don't eat pork.
Are you Jewish?
No, I ain't Jewish. I just don't dig on swine, that's all.
Why not?
Pigs are filthy animals. I don't eat filthy animals.
Yeah, but bacon tastes good. Pork chops taste good.
Mark, I couldn't help but play that because it sort of says it all, doesn't it?
It does. There's a few areas in which pigs are unfairly maligned. They actually will. They do avoid their own waste, but they do like to wallow. They do eat filthy things, so some would consider them a filthy animal.
The Quran also forbids the flesh of the swine, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it was another desert religion. It draws its tradition from Abraham as well, and this was one, unlike Christians, they decided to preserve that particular taboo.
Mark, stay with us, please. Mark Essick, author of Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig, is our guest in this hour of midday. We'll take a short break and come back and talk some more about this. If you have any comments or questions, we welcome phone calls to 410-662-8780 is our local phone number. You can reach us by email to midday@wypr.org. If you have a view of the pig, a comment about pigs, maybe you've raised pigs, maybe you've had pigs as pets, maybe you just, you know, avoid pork because of the reputation of the pig, or for religious reasons, of course we understand. But anything you'd like to say, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780. Any question you might have. A short break at midday. We'll be right back.
This is a tale about an unprejudiced heart and how it changed our valley forever. There was a time not so long ago when pigs were afforded no respect except by other pigs. They lived their whole lives in a cruel and sunless world.
It's the opening narration from the 1995 film Babe. Which a lot of our listeners remember this movie. It tells the story of a pig who wants to be a sheepdog. And I mentioned it here in our conversation with Mark Essig because, you know, there you have a cuddly pig that wants to be something other than what he is in life. I just wanted to take a moment here to ask you about that movie. You know, the pig in pop culture. Sometimes you see adorable depictions of pigs. Other times they're filthy animals that people don't want to think about. What are your thoughts about the way the pig was depicted in that film, Mark Essig?
Well, the pig in Babe, it's essentially the same plot as in the great E.B. White story, Charlotte's Web. Mm-hmm. And it gets to the dilemma of pighood, whereas chickens, you keep those, they will give you eggs. You keep a cow, you milk it, you get milk and cheese. You keep sheep and you can shear them and get wool. But pigs don't give you anything else. Pigs are only good for one thing, and that is producing meat. So when the dilemma, the plot in both Babe and Charlotte's Web is driven by a pig who realizes this sad story that his life is due to end and he's going to become bacon and ham rather soon, and he has to develop some other skill, whether it's herding sheep or inspiring a spider to write words in its web. It also gets to something else in that other farm animals, sheep, cows, they tend to live outside of town. They live on pasture, whereas pigs, they live right around the house. There's a great scene in Charlotte's Web where they enumerate all of the things that Wilbur is eating for breakfast, and it's really the scraps of everything the family has eaten for the last day. And so you get a lot of, you find a lot of memoirs and stories written about people who lived with their pigs in close intimacy. They went to visit them every day. They fed them. You share your meals with these animals. And then before too long, you butcher them and they end up on your plate themselves. So the pig for many years it lived as a sort of edible pet right outside the homes of people. And it required some some strange emotional distancing in order to let people continue to do this.
You make the point in your book, Lesser Beasts, that pigs are pretty sharp, pretty intelligent creatures, but their cleverness has never been the pig's primary value to human beings.
Yeah, there are stories going back, like that there was a phenomenon of, right around the time of the American Revolution, there were learned pigs, and this was a tradition where you would train a pig to count or tell time or maybe even read minds. And essentially, it's burlesque. You're training this most debased and lowly of creatures to perform higher mental functions. And you can find it as early as ancient Rome. Pliny the Elder has an account of pigs who were on board a ship at sea that started to list and threatened to sink. And the pigs all piled up on the opposite side of the ship so they could rebalance it, and it sailed on. So there's long been a tradition that pigs are very intelligent, and there is some science to back it up. Animal behavioralists have done studies of pigs and learned that they're very skilled at certain tasks, that they have a very flexible intelligence in terms of locating food and memory and that sort of things. And there's even theories that this might be related to their diet. After all, when you think about a sheep, what's its task? It's to spot something green and to start chewing it. Whereas a pig, being an omnivore, it has to make decisions about what to eat. If you find a new source of food, that's a great selective advantage, evolutionarily speaking. But on the other hand, if you find a new source of food that happens to be a poison mushroom or a seed with cyanide, that's a disadvantage. So they had to learn to be selective in much the same way that people can be selective about what they eat. So in that dietary requirement was created a spur to the evolution of intelligence.
Mark, I hope you don't mind another pop cultural reference again here.
Bring them on.
Another testament to the intelligence of pigs from our pop culture. Arnold the pig from Green Acres, who figured out how to deliver newspapers.
Oh, hello, Arnold. I thought that was Joey's paper route. What happened to him? Oh, he's sick, huh? Gee, that's too bad. Well, see you around.
Yeah, sorry about the Green Acres reference there. That's Mr. Kimball in the conversation with Arnold the Pig, another effort to make the pig, depict the pig as intelligent and adaptable creature.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't really imagine a horse or a sheep in that role. And partly it has to do with facial expressions. Pigs have this sort of permanent smile because of the way their mouths are arranged and the way they snort, and they just have a curiosity about them. I will add one sad side note is that there were a number of pigs who played Arnold. They had to be piglets because pigs get less cute as they get older. But the original Arnold ended up as pork chops in his trainer's freezer, which is another indication that even if we think these creatures are smart, we still end up eating them most of the time.
Right. See them as pork. I wanted to go back to the prejudice that developed against the pig. You know, you make a point here. You do some math here. 14 million Jews, 1.6 billion Muslims by religious doctrine must avoid pork. So when these edicts came out, hundreds of years, thousands of years ago, people had to adjust, right? Because by then people were eating the pig. Or you're saying they weren't around in those cultures as much as in other cultures, maybe.
Yeah, I don't think when the edict came out in
Leviticus, for
Palestine
instance.
In 800 BC, perhaps. It probably didn't change the diets of very many people. It became an issue later, once Jews moved to other lands where they were living among Christians and other peoples who did eat pork. And then often the resistance to eating pork, it became a central marker of Jewish identity. When Jews were living mostly among other people who didn't eat pork, it didn't seem to be terribly important. There are not a whole lot of references in Jewish scripture to pork eating. But once Jews moved into Europe and they were living among among Christians, most of whom did eat pork, then it really became central to the Jewish sense of self.
Okay. How about the Romans? They revered the pig.
Yeah, that it's a curious circumstance because, of course, the Romans ended up as the rulers of the Jews, and they were mostly just puzzled by the reluctance of their new subjects to eat pork. And the reason is that I think you could safely say that no one before or since has loved pork as much as the Romans did. There's one surviving collection of recipes from ancient Rome. And if you page through it, you'll find just a handful of recipes for beef. You'll find a few more, about a dozen or so for lamb, and then just dozens and dozens for pork. There are 17 recipes for suckling pig alone in this book. And then there are some extremely bizarre things, like they would eat the uterus of pigs. They were very fond of pig brains. And it wasn't just eating them. They considered them part of their ritual sacrifice. They would sacrifice pigs to the gods on some of their most important occasions. And so the reasons, like when you try to explain why the Romans loved pigs so much and why Jews hated them so much, I mean, it has to do with some rather complicated reasons of theology. But it also, I think at a basic level, has something to do with the way pigs lived. The Near East was largely a desert land, and just about the only place that pigs could live was as scavengers on city streets. The Italian peninsula, by contrast, you had oak forests, and a lot of pigs lived in the woods, rooting up roots and eating acorns in the fall. Rome was also a very wealthy empire. They drew on imports of barley and wheat and other grains from all over the Mediterranean, and some of those grains ended up as feed for pigs. So whereas pigs were eating garbage in the Near East, they were eating acorns and grains in Italy. They lived cleanly, they ate well, they tasted delicious, and as a result, the Romans really embraced pork.
Historian Mark Essig is our guest in this hour of midday here on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here. Mark's book is Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig, published by Basic Books. I have one more question for you for now, and then we're going to take some from our listeners, Mark. I was thinking about the way the pig sort of domesticated itself, started hanging around humans and eating their scraps and becoming familiar to humans, not living out in the pasture, but living actually on the street, even near the homes of in the barnyards and all that. What about dogs, though? Couldn't you say something similar about dogs and man together? Dogs now considered man's best friend, pigs considered pork. What about that?
Yeah, and in fact, this model of pig domestication that I was talking about, it's actually derived largely from models of dog domestication, which there's a lot of controversy about the dating of that, but it's thought to have happened even earlier, that wolves would follow bands of hunter-gatherers because the hunter-gatherers, they hunted, they left scraps behind, these wolves can eat it. So by the same process, the wolves were best at fulfilling this niche, they evolved into domestic dogs. So the process is thought to be the same. The difference is that dogs had other skills. They could act as sentries warning you of people trying to sneak into town. They could assist you in tasks such as herding sheep. They could just be companionship. Rather, they acted as pets. So you could say that dogs developed these other skills that made them worth keeping around, whereas pigs, they just stuck to their... you could say that they're scavenging of food. They acted as garbage men. That certainly was a useful service. But for the most part, the main reason you kept pigs around was to eat them. So dogs diversified their skill set, whereas pigs did not. But I will add that in a lot of these texts, particularly from the ancient world, dogs and pigs are mentioned in the same breath. There's a curse, may dogs and pigs drag your corpses through the streets. So they really had the same role as in some cultures as being filthy pariah animals that were carrion and garbage eaters.
Mark, we'll pick up on the history again after we take a couple of calls from our listeners here on the Midday Show. Suzanne in Elkridge, Maryland, for Mark Essig, our guest. Go right ahead, Suzanne. Hi.
This is Dan.
I'm sorry. Yeah, this is Dan. And is this Suzanne?
No. Van with a V.
Van, I'm sorry.
Yes, yes. We were on your show, my friend Kathy and I, talking about chickens. And we now have gotten into American guinea hogs. And this is a heritage antique breed that is a small, very, very friendly pig. We started out with 4, and I think we now have 28. But they're much easier to handle than a 700-pound pig.
I guess
and,
so.
And I think it's wonderful that a lot of small farms are preserving these heritage breeds. Thomas Jefferson had them.
These pigs, yeah, Thomas Jefferson had them. He ate them, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's sort of the whole point. These are not pets, right?
No, these are not pets.
Yeah.
They get to be about, a boar will be about 250, but that's a whole lot easier to handle for a small farm than a 600-pound pig.
Yeah, I could never, thank you for calling. I just could never do what you do. I'd become attached to pigs. I think pigs are kind of cool, and I have a problem with this. Just thinking about, it's a very nice phone call, and she... And I like pork, too. I just don't want to face it. You know, I think that's it. That's my problem, Mark. Have you thought about that, too?
Yeah, it's really the way that the entire livestock system has moved. I do want to backtrack a little bit and say that I love American guinea hogs. They're really beautiful animals. What Van is talking about there is an important role that pigs have always played, because a lot of people who have small farms, I know a lot of people who have small vegetable operations, and they'll just keep a pig or two or three or four around, because what they function as converters of waste. They can take all those vegetables that are too ugly to serve at the farmer's market, all those squash that you didn't quite notice that grew to be 5 or 6 pounds. you can feed it to your pigs, otherwise would be waste turns into pork. And then the point you made about facing them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I spent some time working on a small hog operation, and, the place I've come down now, I've stopped eating grocery store pork. I'll still eat pork, but I have to know where it came from, and I have to know that the pig lived a good life before it got sent to the slaughterhouse. So I have worked with, There's a pig on the jacket of my book, and people ask me if it's my pet, and I have to say no. That was just one of the pigs on the farm. That I may well have eaten part of that pig because I do buy some pork from that same farm.
What can you say about that farm that makes it okay for you to eat that pork? What do you like about that farm?
What I like about that farm is the sows, the female pigs. They live on pasture. Almost all of them get pregnant by having an encounter with a boar, which almost never happens with commercial sows, who are almost entirely artificially inseminated. The pigs, they do not. Most commercial hogs will be living on hard, slatted floors inside barns. They will never feel mud or grass or even straw under their feet. So they spend their lives just running around on pasture, rooting in the grounds, and then they are killed. So if you need to look at it in comparison with the vast number, with the way the vast number, say 95-97% of American hogs are raised, and it's really being appalled by those conditions that made me restrict my diet when it comes to pork.
Thank you, Mark. Let's take another call from Mark Essig. This is Tom in Baltimore. Tom, go right ahead.
Hi, everybody. Mark, you're an expert on these pigs and all. I understand that over the years, humans have used cows, goats, and even horses as a source of milk. In your research, have you ever encountered any culture, even an individual, that ever used pig milk for human consumption?
You know, I've run into people, I've read articles about it where people have tried to milk pigs. It doesn't work out. For one thing, pigs have a dozen or so teats, And so there's a physiological question, whereas a cow, for instance, will let down the milk into an udder, which sort of concentrates it in order to be drawn off all at once. And as far as I know, it's probably has partly to do with the physiology of lactation in the pigs. I would say it would probably have something to do with the temperament of a pig, because if you've ever been around an adult sow, you wouldn't want to try to get any milk out of her. They can be rather aggressive and defensive animals, which is not to say that probably a wild cow would be that way too. It's not, I'd say it's not something I can give you a definitive answer for, but if you've ever been around a pig, I wouldn't want to try to milk her.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Gene in Pikesville, you're on Midday Next. Hi.
Yeah, fascinating subject. I didn't had no idea I would be this interested in pigs, but one of my most favorite pigs was Miss Piggy, and as a a lover of cartoons when I was a kid, I just was so enamored with Miss Piggy.
From the Muppets.
Yeah, the Muppets.
Yeah.
She had those vinyl plastic boots on, man.
Oh, she is great. Miss Piggy's great.
She was something else.
Yeah. Well, I like her in Muppet Treasure Island as Queen Shakalaka.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the other thing, my other remembrance of a pig was when I was about 7 or 8, we used to go to this, I don't know if it was a farm, but they had pigs. And as kids, we would, our parents would let us get sticks and scratch the pigs' backs. Mm-hmm. And they seemed to enjoy it. I don't know if they enjoyed it, but we sure enjoyed doing it. The other thing is kind of a cultural thing. I used to have a cafe. And in the cafe, I noticed when I would have, I would run pork loin. And the white people loved pork loin. But the black people didn't like it. Well, I don't know if they didn't like it, but they were more, they liked the pork chops with the bone.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Has anybody else ever noticed that but me?
That's very interesting. I mean, the pork was marketed as the other white meat, right? Starting sometime in the 80s or 90s, I guess that was. And this idea that it's leaner or something. I don't know. Gene, what made you just think, you noticed that it's about your black and white customers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just a difference. When I ran it on the menu, I'm serious, the white customers would really get the platters. And the black people would say, well, is it pork chops? And
no,
I would say, we would say no. And they wouldn't buy it unless it had the bone in. They just preferred it with the bone.
That's interesting. Let me ask Mark about that. When you talk about class or ethnic groups when it comes to pork, I mean, aside from the religious issues, what observations do you have about that? That's what Gene's question or comment makes me think of that, because I know that pork was associated at some point, it became known as the food for poor people, right?
That happened fairly early. I would say to Gene that I think his black customers had better taste because any meat when it's on the bone is going to have more flavor.
Absolutely.
I've not heard about that particular distinction, but yeah, the association of pork with poor people, it goes back, as we mentioned, all the way to the ancient world, in the ancient Near East, where only people who couldn't afford other foods were eating pork. You find it in Europe in the Middle Ages, and it seems to be that pork was simply the most inexpensive meat. It was the key fact about pigs is that they reproduce extremely quickly. A cow, it'll take 9 months to gestate and will give you a calf or two. But a pig takes less than 4 months to gestate, will give you six or a dozen or more piglets. And then they all reach slaughter weight within 6 months or a year long ago. So that if you wanted to produce a lot of meat quickly, the pig is your animal. Now, the other side of that is that it meant that it was the most inexpensive meat and therefore the lowest status meat. So as soon as people started to make a little more money, they could give up their diet of grains and porridge and start buying a little meat, they would start buying pork. And of course, for the people, upper classes, who were more concerned with maintaining their status, that meant they had to move into something slightly more elite. And that really carries through. You'll find studies from, say, the 19-teens and 1920s in the U.S., the same thing tracks. The poorer you are, the more pork you eat, when you start making more money, you don't start buying more pork, you start buying less pork and buying more beef. So it's really
right.
Ancient cultural prejudices about where status lies.
It was interesting when Emeril got on television, Emeril Lagasse got on TV and started saying pork rules, and pork became kind of cool, culturally cool, as a cool part of cuisine to put on the plate. I went to a restaurant in Washington. I'll never forget this. The pork was prepared in such a way, I probably cannot describe the way it was prepared properly, but it looked raw to me in the middle and cooked on the outer rim. It was a tenderloin, right? And I had a problem looking at it and thinking that it was still raw, but apparently this was some cool culinary trick. My brother, who was seated next to me, said there was nothing wrong with it. There's no trichinosis. So let me ask you about trichinosis. I remember hearing that word a lot when I was a kid, you know, that you had to cook pork thoroughly or else you would get this disease. Is that true?
It was once true. First, since you brought it up, I will say that a lot of people think that Jews don't eat pork because of trichinosis, that essentially Leviticus was a public health book that warned people against the dangers of this food. But it's almost certainly not the case. There's no evidence that there was trichinosis in the ancient Near East, or if there was, people could not have made this connection. But it's a nasty little parasite. It's transmitted by undercooked pork. It will go into your stomach and then migrate into your muscles where it insists itself. And it can cause severe difficulties in health. It used to be a problem in the pork supply in the U.S., and there's a specific reason for this that goes back to the nature of pigs. They are garbage eaters, and it used to be back, especially up through World War II and even a little after, a lot of cities got rid of their municipal garbage by feeding it to pigs. Secaucus, New Jersey was known as the pig capital of the East, because farmers would collect garbage from Manhattan, truck it out to their pig farms, fatten pigs, then have the pigs slaughtered and truck it back to Manhattan. The problem with this is that some of that waste contained raw pork scraps, and so which was a perfect mechanism for transmitting not only trichinosis but other diseases and letting them persist. So you would see fairly common reports about trichinosis being spread through pork. Then there were laws passed that if you're feeding garbage to pigs, you have to cook it first. And essentially it has been, trichinosis is eliminated from the pork supply. So it's safe to eat medium pork. And even if there is trichinosis in it and you cook it, I think 137 Fahrenheit is the temperature, which is, you know, medium. Even that is safe to eat. So I think you can tuck into that pink pork loin without worry is my advice to you.
Thank you very much. Mark, we'd have to take a break. We'll come back and wrap up here. Mark Lessig, our guest, Lesser Beasts is his book, A Snout to Tail History of the Humble Pig. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. We'll be right back. Back with Mark Essig, The History of the Pig and Man, a book called Lesser Beasts. Joe in Annapolis had a question for Mark Essig. Is he still there? Joe, are you there?
Yeah, yes, I'm here.
Go right ahead.
What's the difference between a hog and a pig? And is pork better for you than eating beef, because the pork is considered a white meat, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's how it's marketed. So is there any difference between a pig and a hog, Mark?
No, the taxonomy of the terms can get a little complicated depending on which region or which country you're living in. Mm-hmm. Many people use them interchangeably, but sometimes people will use pig for a younger pig and a hog for an older pig.
Okay.
But generally, I use them interchangeably in the book.
And on the health question, you know, this is a very smart thing the pork industry did in coming up with that phrase, the other white meat.
Yeah, that was pretty much straight marketing. The context of it, this happened in the late 80s that campaign got started. is that sales of pork relative to sales of chicken were plunging. This was the era where everybody was scared to death of animal fats and cholesterol. And people wanted to eat bone-dry, tasteless chicken breast. So the pork producers said, well, what we can do is we can make our pigs taste just like that, just as awful as those chicken breasts taste. And so that was really the strategy. They through very careful selection, they produced an extremely lean pig. So you ended up with pork chops that could be as pale and lean as a chicken breast. So
right.
No, I don't think it would not make it any healthier than beef, and these issues of the dangers of fat and protein are always up in the air. Consensus seems to be is eat less meat of any kind if you really want to be healthy.
Right.
But no, I don't think the whiteness of a chicken breast of a pork loin will not make it any healthier than a steak.
That farm that you were speaking of in North Carolina, the pork that you purchased from that farm, what would you say about it in terms of a culinary experience?
It tends to, the pork chop in particular is where you'll notice the difference, because that's really the part of a commercial hog that they have bred to be super lean, the pork loin and the tenderloin. A pork loin of a free-range hog, generally they have bloodlines so that they will get more intramuscular fat, so they will be juicier and taste better. And the other thing is that these pigs move around more. They actually get exercise. And the reason, for instance, that a chicken leg is darker than a breast is because the leg moves and the breast does not, because a breast is a flight muscle that chickens don't use to fly. So that's why it stays pale without hemoglobin in it. And so you will find more color, more flavor, more fat, more complexity in a pastured pork chop than you will in a commodity pork chop.
Hmm. We're about out of time in this hour, Mark. I have enjoyed this, and we've enjoyed your book. The relationship between pigs and humans, some people see great similarities between us, don't they?
Yeah, great similarities. If you look at our teeth, we have the same full set of mammal teeth because we have very similar diets. We need them to process everything from plant material to meat. If you look at our brains, our brains have developed in somewhat similar ways. Humans more advanced in certain ways than the pigs, of course. We have used pig parts for heart valves, for instance, to translate into people. We use them pigs as medical models for a variety of different diseases. And so it really, when you think about the partnership between people and pigs, it really has become far deeper than simply a source of meat.
Well, I've enjoyed this very much, Mark. Thank you very much for your time. And I'll tell our folks again, the book is called Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig. Mark Essig is the author also of Edison and the Electric Chair, and he's written for The Times, New York Times, LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle. We spoke to him from Asheville, North Carolina. And are you still teaching at Warren Wilson?
No, I haven't been out there for a few years.
Okay.
I worked on their farm. That's where the farm was, and that's where I did a little teaching as well. Now I'm just scribbling full time.
Well, good for you. And Mark, we've enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our midday for today. I hope you enjoyed the program. You'll come back for some more. You can find an article that Mark Essig wrote about the pig for NPR posted on the Dan Rodericks Facebook page. Today's lunch was provided by Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, sandwiches, pastas, and salads that are made fresh daily. Bagby Pizza is open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Delivery is available nightly from 5 to 9 p.m. Please check out our podcast at wypr.org. If you miss a program or part of a program, you can find it there. Thanks, everybody. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you again soon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Samantha Max, Beatrix Lockwood, and Max Bookdahl. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at wypr.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.